Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We welcome to the show Dr. Jeffrey Cummings talking about Alzheimer's disease and how he believes there are ways to treat, reverse, and prevent this horrible disease from affecting you or members of your family. Up next is one of Australia's premier hip-hop groups, Hilltop Hoods, chatting about their latest album, Walking Under Stars. Relationship coach Frank Kermit drops by talking about coping with the end of a relationship, and we showcase some new music from Gwen Stefani, Baby Don't Lie.
Capture your need for sound.
Receiving the news that you or your loved one has Alzheimer's disease is a crushing blow. It's beyond scary and feels like a sentence to a long and drawn-out death. And although a recent study by Dr. Jeffrey Cummings of the Cleveland Clinic found more than 200 medications to treat the disease were ineffective, he says there are ways to treat, reverse, and prevent Alzheimer's. We're happy to welcome Dr. Cummings to the show to share his findings. Dr. Cummings, thank you for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for having me on the show, Kelly. I'm happy to be here.
So briefly, Dr. Cummings, for people who don't really know what Alzheimer's is, because I think, you know, we all know it's a quote-unquote bad word, what does the disease entail really?
The disease that we call Alzheimer's disease is a loss of nerve cells in the brain that usually begins later in life and progresses in symptoms from being a mild memory impairment to increasingly severe memory impairment and involvement of other types of thinking. And then finally, in the final phases of the disease, people lose the ability to walk, and eventually they lose the ability to swallow, and they eventually die of the illness. So Alzheimer's disease is a fatal illness. It takes about a decade for the average patient to succumb to their illness.
I think a lot of people believe that this is, you know, a quote-unquote old person's disease, but it does present itself in younger people as well, correct?
That is correct. The youngest patient that I've ever taken care of was 35 years old. In the younger cases, there tends to be a more important genetic influence on the illness. So those cases that begin in their 50s or even in their early 60s are more likely to have genes that are contributing to the disease, whereas those that begin in their 70s and 80s and 90s are less likely to have genetic influences.
Is the disease hereditary, Dr. Cummings?
What is inherited are risk factors, Kelly, so that we know that there's one important gene that increases the likelihood that one will get the disease. But there are people who have that gene and never get it. And, of course, there are people who get the disease and don't have the gene. So we don't use it as a diagnostic test, but we do know that it increases the risk. And this takes us to the whole discussion of risk reduction and risk increase. So we don't have any way to completely prevent the disease. We cannot say that if you do all of these things, that you will not get the disease. But what we can say is if you pay attention to brain health, you will be less likely to get the disease. And overall, if the public engaged in brain health activities, we would have fewer cases of Alzheimer's disease. Under the optimal circumstances, about a third fewer cases.
I do want to get into these preventative measures, if you will. I just wanted to ask you before we get there, for a person who might be worried that this could happen to them, what are some of the signs that you might have it and you might start to see first?
Well, the most common sign of Alzheimer's disease in the early phases is repeated questioning. The brain strikes the area of the disease strikes the area of the brain in which recent memory is stored. Mom might ask, well, did my son call this morning? And the husband would say, yes, we had a good discussion with him. And then an hour later, she would say, well, did my son call this morning? And you would realize that she wasn't storing this information that was being given to her. And it's often very confusing to families because remote memory remains intact. So this same woman could tell you the name of her first grade teacher. And people say, well, her memory's terrific. She remembers all of the things about our early life together. And yet, if she's not storing recent information and asking the same question again and again, that is a sign we're very concerned about.
Dr. Cummings, do you notice or know if it's more prevalent in men than women or vice versa? And do you notice racial statistics, like is it more in white people than African Americans, for example?
It is more likely to occur in women. And of course, women live longer, so there are more women in the risk period than there are men. But even when you account for that, women are at a slightly greater risk for Alzheimer's disease than men are. So women, this is definitely a woman's disease, both from the total numbers because of longevity and of the relative numbers because there's some sort of biological risk that women have. In terms of the ethnic diversity, there does seem to be a greater prevalence in both Hispanic and African American minorities. This may well be related to other diseases. Both hypertension and diabetes are risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, and both of those conditions are overrepresented in African American and Hispanic individuals.
Joining us on the show is Dr. Jeffrey Cummings, the director of the Cleveland Clinic Lou Ruvo Center for Brain Health. Dr. Cummings, does a person's diet come into play with this disease? Can, like, eating particular foods help?
We believe so. Looking across the world at the epidemiology of Alzheimer's disease, we can see that people who have a Mediterranean type of diet have less Alzheimer's disease. So if they have a higher percentage of fish, a lower percentage of red meat, proteins are obtained from fish and from nuts. There's a high proportion of vegetables and fruit. And this is generally a healthier diet. And there is a reflection of that in brain health and in a reduced risk for Alzheimer's.
What other forms of prevention can help ward off the disease? Because I know you keep mentioning brain health. So what should we be doing to train our brain, I guess?
Well, we think that brain exercises are very important. We have worked with a number of these programs that people are involved with, like Lumosity and Dacom and Posit Science, and I don't want to endorse any particular one of these, but there are a number of companies working in this area that are helping to have brain fitness as part of our overall approach to brain health. And there are some data that support the use it or lose it approach to brain health.
I wanted to ask you as well with regards to people who might suffer from addiction, whether it's alcohol addiction or drug addiction. Does this play into perhaps, contracting the disease?
There's a general principle at work here, Kelly, which is that anything that injures the brain will make it more likely that the person will develop a dementing illness and cognitive decline like Alzheimer's disease late in life. So that's true of brain injury, for example. People who have a head injury and are knocked out are more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease late in life. So we see it in people who had severe alcohol problems in the same way. They've injured their brain and they've lowered their resistance, if you will, to Alzheimer's disease. But we do not see specific linkages between Alzheimer's disease and alcohol or addiction.
If someone has early stage Alzheimer's, can it be reversed, Dr. Cummings?
It cannot be reversed, but it can be treated. We do have five approved medications, four in one class and one in another class, and we frequently combine these classes of drugs. And with good management and appropriate dosing and early intervention, we can keep people functioning at a higher level for a longer period of time than if they are not treated. So although these drugs are not as strong as we would like, they do make a difference. And it is important to be under medical care and to be receiving the treatments that we have available.
Do you think, Dr. Cummings, that you will eventually be able to have a cure or at least, medication that really sort of knocks this out? Do you think it's coming?
I think it's coming, Kelly. We're understanding the disease better. We have better techniques like brain scanning that are so essential in terms of developing new treatments for Alzheimer's disease, because then we can really see if we are having an effect on the disease, which we can't if we're just asking the patient, of course. That's a very indirect way of seeing if we're having an effect on the disease. So our tools are evolving. It is a slow process. We don't know whether we're one step away or 100 steps away from a breakthrough therapy, but I think it's coming and we just have to keep working at it.
Before I let you go, Dr. Cummings, I just wanted to ask you this. If someone has a family member with the disease, what would you suggest are the main priorities in trying to manage and help the situation?
Well, if a family member has a disease, first of all, that family member needs a lot of attention. We know that there's a risk for driving, for example. We know that there's safety risk. We want that person to have a good diagnosis, make sure that there's not something that's being overlooked, like a vitamin deficiency or a thyroid problem. So they need a good evaluation. They need to get into the therapies that you and I have talked about. And then the family member now knows that they are also at risk. They are at risk by virtue of the fact that their family is affected, and therefore getting involved with the brain health activities that you and I have talked about is very important in terms of reducing their own risk for the disease.
I realize one more thing that has actually been in my mind for a while, and I almost forgot to ask you, is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia. Is it closely linked diseases, Dr. Cummings, or are they really separate issues?
They're closely linked. The word dementia is a general term that means cognitive deficits sufficient to produce a functional or activities of daily living problem. And Alzheimer's disease, then, is the most common cause of dementia, but there are other causes of dementia, like stroke or head injury or vitamin deficiency or thyroid problems. So we look at a person and we say, okay, they have the syndrome of dementia. Now, what is the cause of that dementia? And the cause is likely to be Alzheimer's disease, but there are other causes of dementia that need to be investigated by the physician or clinician.
Excellent. Dr. Cummings, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Kelly. Thank you for having me on your show.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Cummings, the director of the Cleveland Clinic Lou Ruvo Center for Brain Health.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Joining us on the show is one of Australia's premier hip-hop groups, the Hilltop Hoods. These guys have redefined the rap game in their home and native land and are now reaching out to other parts of the world to spread their music and grab new fans. We're excited to talk about their career and new album, Walking Under Stars. On the line is group member Suffa. Welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much.
So, Suffa, can you talk to us about how you guys actually came together, and did you know pretty quickly that you, as a group, had something special going on?
That makes the assumption that we think we're something special.
I feel with all the album charting you're doing, I think you are quite special.
Me and Persia, the guy I run with, we have a good chemistry, and we get along really well as people, so hopefully that translates into music.
And over the last several years, you've been, you know, smashing all kinds of chart records, if you will, in Australia. What does that feel like, knowing that you've, I would say, broken new ground for hip-hop in your country?
It's good. I mean, especially being able to see younger acts come through, sort of what's happened earlier in our careers and the things that we sort of had to deal with coming up. It's nice that other artists that we're sort of bringing up and that we're fans of as well don't sort of have to go through the same thing.
Has it been hard to be taken seriously in other places, apart from Australia? Because, you know, I'm not sure if just the thought of hip-hop screams Australia, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, initially a lot of people can sort of go, "You're what?" including the person I just met outside my hotel today. But in general, once they hear the music or see the show, they sort of get it. We're not trying to be something that we're not. We tell our story. We don't, it's not like American rap music. It's very much our own sort of hip-hop music, and it's very much ourselves. So, yeah, if we get it in front of people, they tend to get it, I feel.
Are you guys, you know, as leaders of the scene, I would say, trying to expand its reach and give it more credibility, you know, around the world?
I mean, when we're, like, touring the States and stuff like that, obviously, like, our focus is us and the group and stuff like that, but it's great if there's a byproduct that other similar artists and, you know, other Australian artists are able to do a tour because of it, then that's awesome.
Joining us on the show is Suffa from the Hilltop Hoods, again, one of Australia's premier hip-hop groups. You can learn more about them on their website, hilltophoods.com. The new album, you know, Walking Under Stars, is it a part two to your previous album, Drinking from the Sun, or is it really two separate projects? Because I know there was like a cryptic message on both.
Well, yeah, it's supposed to be a companion piece to our last album, Drinking from the Sun. And there's things on it like, we've got sort of this interlude, The Thirst, that runs throughout both projects. And there's songs that we're working on during Drinking from the Sun that appear on Walking Under Stars that weren't finished for whatever reason. And, yeah, they're sort of linked in that manner. But having said that, they're kind of two very different records. Like, Walking Under Stars is a lot more soulful, whereas Drinking from the Sun was a lot more traditional.
Okay. Now, when it comes to your writing process, do you write mainly at home? Do you write as the group, like as a unit? Do you come in with separate parts? And can you write on the road? I know some artists are all about writing on the road and others need to sort of be in their little nook and cranny.
I need a nook.
Very good.
Whenever I'm on the road, I'm just trying to either get to the show or get to a bed, pretty much. Like, because we put a lot into our shows, it can sort of be exhausting on the road. And, yeah, I find it way easier to write when I'm back home. But having said that, like, I tend to write like sort of a crazy person. I'll always be taking voice memos and stuff like that to myself wherever I am. So if anyone finds my phone ever and manages to get into my voice memos, I'm going to come off like kind of a crazy person.
And, you know, Suffa, is it important for you when you're writing? Because, you know, I've interviewed a lot of singing artists, I guess, if I can put it that way. But you guys are obviously rhyming. Do you have like a certain beat in your head as you're writing? Like, do you need to kind of have some of the music down first? Or can you really just sort of write your rhymes and then add in the music later or work the music into how your rhyme is going to work?
Yeah, no, really. We can go either way sort of thing. We can write a piece of music, or you can have something that you try to find a partner for, sort of thing. It goes both ways with us. We don't sort of have like a strict way that we go about producing music. We try to keep it, you know, as casual and as open as possible.
Now, the album again, Walking Under Stars, the lead single, Won't Let You Down. How did you decide that was the single to kick things off with?
It's just one of the tracks that stood out for us, and we've got Maverick Sabre, an Irish kid, sing the hook, and we're huge fans of him, and he's got a really big voice, so yeah, it just felt to us like the lead single, and it was one of the first tracks we were able to get the samples cleared for as well, so that always helps.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask you as well, you know, I find it fascinating, again, not to be sort of ignorant of what you guys are doing in Australia, but all the way over in Canada, again, I just don't think, again, the hip-hop scene really screamed out to me, oh, Australia. And I'm so happy, like, listening to your music. I'm actually happy to have found out about you guys and know about you guys now, because I think you guys are really talented. But I wanted to know, who did you admire musically growing up? Like, where did you get your penchant for wanting to be in hip-hop?
Well, we grew up around hip-hop for whatever reason. Like, in our city, there was a big graffiti scene and skateboarding scene. And we grew up around, like, Public Enemy and Ice-T and Organized Confusion and BDP and Eric B. and Rakim and all that sort of thing. So we sort of came out through the golden era of hip-hop when we were kids, listening to all that. And, you know, we listened to a ton of Canadian artists as well, like Maestro Fresh Wares and Socrates and stuff when we were kids. So, yeah, we had a ton of influences, but I guess for us, the main influences were like the guys in the middle of the golden era, like your Biggies and your Nas and that sort of thing.
Would you ever want to work with, obviously I know Biggie's not an option, but like, is there someone like right now out of New York or Los Angeles, or even I know, you know, Atlanta has such a hip hop scene as well. Is there anyone, even if it's an artist or a producer that you'd like to work with from America?
Yeah, but I guess you never put that out there. What if they don't want to work with us? I mean, we've ticked off a bunch of our bucket list as we've been progressing through our career. Like, we've worked with Charlie Tuna from J5, Blackfort, Sarah Marsh, obviously Brother Ali on this album. So, yeah, we're gradually going through our bucket list, and we've worked with a gang of people that we're huge fans of.
Okay. On the top 40 side of things, if I can go there for a second, if I understand things correctly, you've actually collaborated with Sia. Is there like a top 40 artist like the Rihannas of the world or the Charlie XCX's of the world that would be fun for you to maybe collaborate with down the line?
I'm not going to lie. I'm not super familiar with like a bunch of pop artists.
Okay.
Because like the reason we know Sia is because she's from Adelaide, the same place we're from.
Okay.
Which is sort of like a small city in Australia, but I'm not super across like the pop scene, but like I'm not like opposed to working with anyone as long as it's genuine and it's creative, and that's the reason. If it's about music, it's not about marketing, then always open to working with new people.
I wanted to ask you this. You know, you guys have such amazing exports from Australia in the acting world, if you will, that have made their way to the States. Like, I'll just use Nicole Kidman as an example. Obviously, I know there's a bunch more, like Russell Crowe and so on and so forth, and have done quite well making the jump to North America. Do you ever feel the need to make that jump to, like, quote-unquote, the mecca of hip-hop, like somewhere in New York or Los Angeles? Like, do you feel like you would need to come there? Because I know, speaking as a Canadian, there's been a bunch of artists that are here, and obviously I know it's a closer, you know, trip for them, but, you know, so many people head either south to New York or south to Los Angeles from Canada. Do you feel the need to ever make that move to the U.S.?
I don't think so. I mean, we're quite happy in our base, and we're a fair way into our career at the moment as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And if it pops off in North America, it pops off, but it's not something we're going to throw the kitchen sink at, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
Like, we've got our families back home and stuff like that, so to uproot everyone is sort of, you know, it's kind of a big deal for us. So, you know, we'll continue touring here as much as we can, and touring in the States as much as we can. And like I said, if it pops off, it's great. But if it doesn't, then, you know, it wasn't meant to be.
How important, Safa, is social media to you guys? Like, obviously, the advent of social media over the last several years has been incredible. Do you find it's played a huge part in getting you more fans?
For sure. Outside of, like, Australia, that's how so many people found us. I mean, there's a video with one of our songs, Noise Lead Section, that a Flatlander BMX made that's, I don't know, it's up to 9 or 10 million views, and a lot of people just know us because of that one video and sort of connected to our music through that. And, you know, like, we've got a pretty good Facebook reach. We've got like 600,000 or something followers on Facebook. And yeah, whenever you're promoting yourself or promoting new music or a show or whatever, it's amazing to be able to reach people like that. And yeah, so it's been super important to us.
Before I let you go, I wanted you to, we actually have a lot of listeners, obviously, that are listening from Canada, but we also have listeners because we're on a radio station over in Australia, in Japan and Malaysia. So we have a lot of probably your fans that are listening. For your Canadian fans or people that are just getting to know you here, what message would you like to leave them with about, you know, who you are and what you're about?
I guess, you know, Hilltop Woods is like, we're a group that we try to make traditional hip-hop, you know, true to the roots of the culture. And as far as our live show goes, we're a party band. So, you know, if you want to party, come to one of the shows. We want to party too.
That is excellent. Safa, thank you so much for your time. We wish you all the best.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
That is Safa again of the Hilltop Hoods, one of Australia's premier hip-hop groups. Make sure to check them out on their website, hilltophoods.com.
Hi, this is Safa from the Hilltop Hoods. You're lounging in the Kelly Alexander Show. What's the deal?
Yeah. Oh, I. They say you can't love and be wise, but I can pretend with you if suddenly I ever had to surrender you. I'd fall in a heap, I'd fall on the floor, and call on the force for you, I'd fall on my sword. If grief ever darkened my door, you light it up the way you brighten up a room, hits me right in the chest. It puts the breath inside of my lungs, just like a leapt in the light of the sun. And in spite of my weary frown, you wear a smile that wears me down, so hear me out. I know that I wasted time when I should have been replacing your last name with mine, and that mistake is mine. Believe me, I wear it like a sunburn. It might disappear, but it won't leave me. I'll carry you on my shoulders, never set you down. Ferry you through the coldness, never let you down. Capturing sands like time through the back of my hand. If I could hold her for a moment to a lap of this land, I'll console you for a moment, then be back in a glance. But I'm so far since we left for the road. We chase the sun around the heavens and glow, searching for the next episode. Problem is letting it go. Be like letting go of everything, a treasure to know. And whenever I go, I think your chest will explode. I'm out with your heart, of brand and leaves death in the crow. Try and understand where I lay my head as my home. And I was in love before this rap shit was ever in vogue. But if you feel that you're ever alone, standing in the same room as me, let's set it in stone. You can't save me, the queen to this devilish road. But you're bravely willing to give a hell of a go, so your touch, your taste is my shame. I can't change, I want you to remain my angel, my heartbeat, come closer. I'm sorry, my soul is yours only, you know this. And you know that I won't be shy talking about what you've given me. Conflict time and you shine through the misery. You walk in a room and light it up, that's just with your entry. You walk in a room and light it up like it was 420. Some people never find out what they have, only ever find out what they had. And I could have been one of them, don't know if I still won't. And that thought hangs around my neck like a millstone. For real though, it's like I lost you, left you, let you go. Before I got to get you, I let you know that you're my refuge and I need you to see. The only one that I let down more than you is me.
And I won't let you down, and I won't let you down. I won't let you down, won't let you down again. Oh, I won't let you down, I won't let you down again.
For the most part, dealing with the end of a relationship is a difficult situation to say the least, even if you are the person that initiates the change. There are a number of emotions you run through, especially if you've been in that relationship for many years. To give us some advice and guidance on how to handle the loss of a relationship is relationship coach Frank Kermit. Frank, thanks for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show this week.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
Frank, when a romantic relationship ends, is it really like dealing with the loss of a loved one? Because I've heard that comparison before.
The way we process mourning and grief on an emotional level is the same, whether you're dealing with the breakup of a relationship or dealing with a death in the family. The emotional process is exactly the same. This is why a lot of books out there that deal with a breakup, you can also use when dealing with the loss of a loved one through death. And books on how to cope with death can and will be recommended for people going through a breakup of a very serious relationship. The emotional process is the same. You're dealing with a sense of loss. You're dealing with the idea of getting used to the new normal.
Okay. And what is this new normal, if you will? And I guess to start off, what exactly are you mourning?
Okay, you're mourning the loss of the familiar. That really, if you want to take away all other elements until you get to the core of it. You're getting used to a new normal way of lifestyle. You're getting used to the new familiar. The fact is that when you are involved with somebody for a long time, we tend to take for granted they're always going to be there. We tend to take for granted all the new little things that that person brings into our lives that permeate every element of our lifestyle. When they're gone, we're not used to them being gone. So every little action you go through, especially in that first year is always the hardest because it's that first year of experiences of the new normal. So I'll give you just a quick example here. You were reading the newspaper or you're checking up some stories online and you come across something that you know your partner would totally be interested in, and your habit is, I'm just going to forward it to my partner, or you're going to clip it out of the newspaper for your partner. And that's when you realize, wait a minute, my partner is not my partner anymore. And you're just reminded in that moment, oh, this repeating behavior pattern that I've been in isn't going to apply anymore. And I have to get used to the new normal way of being without my partner, the normal way of being without this familiar interaction, familiar repeating behavior pattern occurring. And each time you reach that point, you're changing a repeating behavior pattern, you're going to feel that pain. You're going to feel a sense of loss. That's why the first year is always the hardest year, because it's the first time you have to go through each of these instances.
Okay, like birthdays and Christmas and blah, blah.
All these holidays come up. So your birthday comes up and it's your first birthday without your partner. You know, this particular anniversary you may have celebrated, it's your first time without your partner. It's the first time that you're going to do a new season on television for your favorite TV show you used to watch together. And it's coming on and it's the first season premiere without your partner. And we don't tend to realize that even something as trivial as the premiere of a new TV show can be a significant reminder of the pain, the loss we've suffered.
Frank, is there a specific way that you should be dealing with the end of a relationship, or is it different for each and every one of us in a way?
Look, there are a number of different things that people can do to cope with loss. Not all of them are going to work for one person, and not any individual one is going to work for everybody. You're basically going to have to do many different things until you find what works for you. For some people, building a shrine of some sort to the person or to the relationship helps them deal with the sense of loss. For other people, doing that exact thing just pushes the pain deeper and deeper, and that's the worst thing you can do. So you basically have to experiment and find what works for you in terms of how to get over loss. For some people, seclusion, isolation is exactly what they need. They really need to be left alone so that they can deal with their feelings of mourning and loneliness. For other people, that's when they need to be, they just have people around them. Not even talking about the incident, not even saying anything, just to have another human being in their immediate vicinity is exactly what works for them in order to for them to process this. So if you know yourself very well, you can definitely ask for what it is you need. If you don't know yourself, then you're going to have to experiment with whatever you think is working in the moment and to be willing to stop what you're doing and try something else.
Joining us on the show is relationship coach Frank Kermit. Learn more about him on his website, franktalks.com. Frank, I want to further that comment, I guess, because I've noticed, you know, in my own life with friends and family members and all that sort of stuff, and even I would say myself a little bit after I know one particular relationship, you turn into, I call it the I'm every woman or I'm every man moment, where, like, you know, you're out either all the time or thinking you can handle things or everything is so much better now that that partner's gone. And you know, probably a lot of it is true, but I feel like it's almost like you're on this weird adrenaline rush for a bit. Is this the time to sort of go buck wild? And should you be making, you know, big sweeping decisions in this time? Because I know many people, they're on this like weird, I guess it's almost like a hormonal high. And I feel like they want to make decisions that maybe they shouldn't be making right away.
If you're going through a process of mourning, big decision-making is probably the worst thing that you could do. It's different if this is something that you've been wanting to do all of your life, and now, at the point of mourning, you have that opportunity. But if you've never considered something, if this is something you've never ever thought about doing, and you're going to do it now while you're in mourning, usually people tend to suffer some consequences they didn't expect. So let's look at a couple of examples here. You've always wanted to move to a particular city. You've always wanted to go ahead and make a big move and make a big change in your life. This is something you've been thinking about for years. You've never had the opportunity to go before, and you're probably in a position where something major in your life is going to have to change in order to shift you into a position where that opportunity is within reach. Now you're going through a breakup, or you're going through a loss, something really major, something majorly drastic. And through that loss, through the components of that loss, maybe you don't have the obligations you used to have anymore that would keep you tied to that city. That makes sense for someone to say, okay, I'm going on a major, you know, this is something I've been planning all my life, and now I have the opportunity to do it. That's okay. Those type of things are okay. If, however, you only decide that now is the time for you to go on some crazy adventure, thinking it's going to make you feel better because you're dealing with a significant loss, that's when you see it as a red flag.
Okay.
This is not something you ever would have done before. You wouldn't have had the guts to do it before. You wouldn't have been brave enough. But now you're massively trying to escape the pain, and that's what's pushing you to say, well, I'm going to go ahead and do this. And you might not even be ready for that kind of move. This is where sometimes in my practice, I deal with people who, let's say, have moved to the city and they want a face-to-face interaction, and you find out that they're, you know, 1 or 2 weeks away from landing on the street.
Right.
This is where we have to say, hello, people, slow down. You know, hey, this is probably not the best move that you could be making right now because you didn't plan for it. It just went ahead and you're running from something.
Okay.
So major life-changing decisions, including, you know, hooking up with new partners. Something I've seen in my practice is people who have always led a very monogamous, moral type of lifestyle, all of a sudden behave completely differently, where they become very promiscuous, which there's nothing wrong if you are sexually adventurous and you want that type of lifestyle. But if you've never been that way before and you've never held to those values before, and all of a sudden, you are acting out on those values, and you went from being a moral person when you're honest to being an unethical person where you're lying to everybody. This is the issue that you have to be aware of. Not that going out and having sex with strangers and having one-night stands, not that that's a bad thing. As long as everybody involved is a consenting adult and they know what it is that they're doing, and they're being very honest about their intentions, that's fine. But if you're dealing with somebody who's never behaved that way, and all of a sudden now they are behaving that way, and they're lying about it, and they've taken on brand new behavior patterns, that's where we have to say, okay, this is probably some unhealthy behavior here because the consequences could be so dire.
I wanted to ask you about someone who may have lost their quote-unquote identity in the relationship, because I think part and parcel of being in a relationship is you become, you know, this and that one, you know, or whatever. But how do you keep, you know, because I find so many people lose themselves in relationships, and then when the relationship is gone, it's like they're lost for a while. So how do you handle that and maybe learn from it if you know in the past that, like, this has happened? How do you protect yourself from the future? Because I feel like it's a fine line between overprotecting yourself and doing the right thing.
Okay. The answer is easy to explain. It's a little bit challenging to implement. So here it is. If you don't want to lose your particular identity when you're in a relationship, you have to know exactly what your identity is before going into a relationship. Know what your boundaries are. Know what your rules are. Know what you stand for. Be able to articulate all of the values by which you live. If those things are the things that are changing and you're constantly deferring to your partner's opinion, that's somebody who has lost their identity. And there's those people who, it doesn't matter what opinion their partner has, they still have their own minds about what it is they value and what they believe is right and wrong in the world. And they're very clear on that. That's when a person reaches a point where they're not going to lose their identity in a relationship. This is actually one of the lessons I had to learn when I went through my own personal period of development. And that is, I didn't draw any particular lines in the sand about what I believed was right and wrong with the world. And when I was involved with somebody, because I wasn't really sure of myself at a time, I wasn't very confident about myself, I just deferred to the opinion of whoever I was with because I just wanted to make that person happy. And then when that relationship would be over, I would feel like this identity is lost. I don't know who I am. Well, the truth is, if you don't know who you are after a relationship, you probably weren't sure about who you were before the relationship. So this is why, if you don't want to lose your identity when you're in a relationship, be very clear about who it is you are and what you stand for, your values, your boundaries. If I ask you a topic, and let's choose a hot-button topic here. If I ask you a topic about who should have certain rights to do certain things, have an answer, have an opinion. If you're constantly deferring to the opinion of your partner, then you don't have a stance on it. Well, you probably don't have your own identity.
Okay.
When people get into relationships, part of their identity becomes to being in that relationship. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's normal. You know, there's Fred and Wilma, and after a while, the Flintstones become an identity together, and if one of them happens to die or one of them happens to leave, both Fred and Wilma will have to reestablish what parts of their identity that they're still retaining, depending on the type of dilemma that they've encountered, and they become new and deal with the new identity of being a single person again, or a single parent, as it were. So I know that sounds like a silly example, but the process is always the same. If you're really stuck saying, I don't have an identity without being in a relationship, well, I can tell you based on my practice, you probably didn't have a very strong identity to begin with before the relationship.
Frank, when your feelings are on fire, you know, like when, especially I think, if you are the person that has been broken up with and potentially if you didn't really see it coming or, you know, you didn't think it was going to, you know, happen that quickly, the end of it and all that sort of stuff, how can you help yourself stay afloat and see the big picture? Because I know when you're in that mode, everything, for lack of a better explanation, is black. Everything is just dire and terrible.
One of the best ways that I have seen work well with a number of clients is the act of journaling. Go ahead and journal. Part of the reason that people suffer so much when they're dealing with loss is their brains go through various mind loops. They keep thinking about the same thing, and how did we get to this point? Oh, yeah, we went through this, and we went through that, and then this happened. I wonder what would have happened differently if we had done this. And then they play this out to see if it would still come out to the same thing. And, okay, we're back to that original conclusion of where we are. Well, how did we get here? And then it begins again.
Mm-hmm.
The point of journaling is to get all of your thoughts out of your head onto paper so that when you catch yourself looping through again, you are visually aware that that's what's going on. Now, not everybody likes to journal. That's fine. But it is important to get it out of yourself some way. If you're an artist of some kind, create some kind of artwork and see if you're going to keep looping through the same creative ideas through your artwork.
Frank, I wanted to ask you this because I think, you know, especially when you're in the moments of extreme pain, like emotional pain, like you're so angry at that person for doing X, Y, and Z, and then it's over and zippity boppity boo and all that sort of stuff. How do you stop yourself from shutting down? Because I feel like so many people are like, that's it. I'm going to be alone. I can't go through this again. It's not worth it, blah, blah. And we all know you can't say that, you know, like you can't say you're never going to be with someone again. I mean, I'm sure there are people in the world that have followed that idea, but I think for most of us, it's not realistic. I think it's not healthy. But how do you stop yourself from shutting down and building up walls around your heart and your head so that you can't ever let someone else in who might actually be the right person?
Boy, is this a loaded question. I guess we could do an entire series on exactly this topic. But let's look at some of the main points. First and foremost, you have to ask yourself, what did you learn from this relationship? what role did you play in getting involved into this relationship, choosing the wrong partner for yourself, and what red flags did you miss? Look at a relationship as a learning device. This relationship was there to teach you a very important lesson so you don't make these same mistakes when you're with a better suited partner for yourself in the future. So I want you to make a list, everything you've learned, everything you're grateful for about that relationship. Maybe you were in the relationship for no other reason than just to prove to yourself that you could be in a relationship, that you could attract somebody, that you could be loved, and that maybe you are lovable. This is the thing that you have to start thinking about, well, is this a life lesson I had? Did you learn something from, let's say, the mistake that you made that would have led to the breakup? Maybe you took part in a behavior that your partner says, no, I don't want to be with somebody who does this behavior. Maybe your partner just has some very strict rules about no drugs in the house, and then you participated in what you believed was a harmless drug-related experience, and your partner said, harmless or not, I don't want drugs in the house, and you broke that rule, and I'm gone. And maybe that's the catalyst for you to say, I really maybe need to pay better attention to the boundaries that my partner is setting, and realize that when someone says that something's important to them, I should pay attention. So that might be the lesson you need to take from this relationship so you don't make that same mistake in a future relationship.
Okay.
As long as you figure out all the lessons you needed to learn, you can then trust yourself getting into a new relationship. People who don't get into new relationships, they're doing it out of fear of being hurt, out of fear of being rejected, a fear of being, you know, screwed over again. Here's what they're really afraid of. They don't trust themselves to choose better partners and to learn from their mistakes. That's really what they're afraid of. But if they get to the point where every relationship they're in teaches them a lesson so that they can carry that lesson into future relationships, the entire concept of trusting themselves becomes a non-issue. They can trust themselves, and their being able to trust themselves allows them to put their guard down just enough to give the right people in their life a chance.
Frank, thank you so much for this. This has been very helpful.
Kelly, it's always a pleasure. I think we've done maybe a little over 20 of these shows, and it just gets better and better with you.
Excellent. Thank you, Frank. That is relationship coach Frank Kermit. Again, you can learn more about him on his website, franktalks.com.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
We've got some music news for you on the Kelly Alexander Show. As you know, the it girl of the music world the last couple of months has definitely been 20-year-old Meghan Trainor. Her hit song, All About That Bass, being played anywhere and everywhere, but a lot of people really don't know a lot about Meghan herself. Here's some pretty cool facts. When she was auditioning in front of music legend L.A. Reid, she played All About That Bass on just a ukulele. As you can imagine, he signed her to a record deal right then and there. And Meghan, by the way, doesn't just play the ukulele, she can also throw it down on the guitar, piano, and trumpet. Coldplay have recently announced that they're going to be releasing a live album and live DVD Blu-ray off their latest CD, Ghost Stories. The live CD was recorded in London, Sydney, Cologne, Paris, New York, and London. The DVD part of the package will not only contain concert footage, but also 10 music videos, including a director's cut of Magic. You can get your hands on Ghost Stories live on November 24th, just in time for the holiday shopping season. And finally, Pitbull recently announced he's hosting the American Music Awards for the second year in a row. He did such a great job last year in the ratings that the producers of the ceremony have asked him for a repeat. And just like last year, Pitbull will not only host the show, but perform as well. At the moment, the only other confirmed performer is Charlie XCX. Other artists are going to be announced in the next couple of weeks. Iggy Azalea, by the way, tops all nominees with 6 nominations, edging out John Legend, Katy Perry, and Pharrell, who each have 5 apiece. The American Music Awards go live from Los Angeles on November 23rd. And here's some new music for you to sink your teeth into. Gwen Stefani, coach and mentor on The Voice, also part of the hit group No Doubt, is getting ready to release new solo material. It's the first album in a long time from Gwen, and she's getting ready to rock. She's working with Pharrell Williams. Also, her new single, Baby Don't Lie, is co-written by OneRepublic's Ryan Tedder, along with Benny Blanco and Noel Zancanella. So this new album is supposed to be released in December. No real details yet on a release date or the title of the album, but Gwen looks ready to rock. And here is her first single off the upcoming album. It's Baby Don't Lie, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show. Mm-hmm.
Alexander Show.
We really appreciate you hanging out with us on the show this week. And as always, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, Dr. Jeffrey Cummings, Hilltop Hoods, and Frank Kermit. Here is your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time coming from Wayne Gerard Trotman. If you dwell in the past and worry about the future, you will find misery in the present. Please make sure to follow us on all of our social media, on Twitter, at K Alexander Show, on Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show, and on YouTube, Kelly Alexander Show as well, where we've got all of our interviews and a lot of great things happening. Again, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. If you have any comments or questions, drop me a line, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a fantastic week. You and I will chat soon.